Welcome to A Katra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI.
Welcome back to the Deep Dive.
Today we're diving into Kazuo Ishiguro's, well, masterpiece really, The Remains of the Day from 1989. Nobel laureate, Booker Prize winner, quite the pedigree.
It really is. And Ishiguro, his style is just so unique, isn't it? That precision, that control.
Mm-hmm.
But underneath all that restraint, there's this this incredible depth of feeling. He's just brilliant at showing the power of what's not said.
That really hits the nail on the head. And looking through the sources, it's clear this isn't just a story about England fading after the empire. It's a deep, almost uncomfortable look at, well, emotional repression, loyalty, and what that costs a person.
Exactly. So our focus today is Mr. Stevens, this aging butler. It's 1956. He's on a road trip, just 6 days.
Right, the motoring trip.
But that trip is really just... it's a frame, isn't it? A way for him and for us to journey back through his life, his choices, his service to Lord Darlington.
And that's the core conflict, right? It's all happening inside Stevens. This constant battle between his absolute dedication to being the perfect, dignified butler.
Which to him means showing no emotion, no personal needs.
Exactly. And, well, the basic human stuff. Love, making your own moral choices, connection.
It's a collision course, really.
Okay, so let's really get into Stevens himself. He is the absolute picture of an English butler, isn't he? So meticulous, sharp. But his whole world revolves around Darlington Hall and this ideal of great service.
His entire identity seems wrapped up in it. But the sources really suggest, and I think the novel shows, that this dedication isn't strength. It's, well, it's a cage he built himself.
Yeah, cage is a good word, because that relentless pursuit of professional perfection, that's his downfall, isn't it? His tragic flaw.
Absolutely. Yeah. His whole philosophy is built on denying his own feelings. He thinks he's achieving dignity, this noble ideal.
But what he actually achieves is just loneliness. Mm. Deep, profound isolation.
And maybe a kind of blindness, too.
Oh, definite. Think about that memory, the one involving his father. It's just brutal.
It really is. His father, who was also in service, is literally dying upstairs.
Right. During this massive, important international conference happening downstairs at the hall.
And Stevens. He stays downstairs. He carries on, manages the event. He barely even pauses when he gets the news.
And the chilling part is he looks back on that moment, that incredibly detached professional response to his own father's death.
He sees it as a triumph, the peak of his professionalism.
It's just, wow. It really forces you, the reader, to ask, you know, can being incredibly good at your job ever make up for failing to be, well, human, especially in those crucial moments?
Steven certainly seemed to think so. For most of his life, anyway. But the genius of the book, I think, is how Ishiguro shows that self-deception slowly cracking.
And the structure is key to that, isn't it? How it shifts back and forth.
Exactly. You have the 1956 journey, him driving through the countryside, that's the physical movement, but then you get these incredibly vivid dives back into the past, into his memories.
That's the real journey, the emotional one.
Totally.
So the physical trip starts, and he tells himself and us, he's going to visit Miss Kenton. She used to be the housekeeper at Darlington Hall.
Right. But straight away, in those early memories he recalls on the drive, he's very defensive. He spends a lot of time trying to justify Lord Darlington, defend his reputation against all the criticism that came later.
He's shoring up the foundations of his own life's work, isn't he? If Darlington was flawed, what does that say about Stevens's decades of service?
Precisely. But the further he drives, the harder it is to keep the darker memories buried. And this is where it gets incredibly compelling and, frankly, uncomfortable.
Yeah, the political stuff. The gatherings at the hall in the 20s and 30s.
Mm-hmm. We learned that Lord Darlington, maybe his intentions were good, maybe. But he was incredibly naive politically. Dangerously so.
Sympathetic to Nazi Germany. It's quite shocking to read.
It is. And Stevens, with his absolute unquestioning loyalty... He just goes along with it. He becomes complicit.
The worst instance being the dismissal of those two Jewish staff members.
Yes. At the request of Nazi sympathizers visiting the hall, Darlington gives the order and Stevens carries it out. Just like that. No hesitation, no question, no personal objection voiced.
Because it wasn't his place to have an opinion, right? He saw it as just executing an order.
He completely abdicated his own moral responsibility. Mm-hmm. He confused loyalty, this professional virtue, with needing to be morally neutral, even when faced with something clearly wrong.
It's a devastating portrait of how duty can curdle into something else entirely.
It really is. Then, later on the trip, there's that moment his car breaks down and locals mistake him for a gentleman, a lord even.
Oh, right. And he's secretly so pleased by that.
Immensely pleased. And it tells you so much, doesn't it? About his complicated feelings about class, but also just how cut off he is from ordinary human interaction. He doesn't know how to just be with people outside his role.
And that inability to connect, that's most painfully obvious with Miss Kenton, isn't it? She's his opposite in so many ways.
Absolutely. She's the emotional heart, in a way. Warm, direct, always trying to get past that stiff professional front he puts up.
Which leads us to that scene, the one everyone remembers, the pantry scene.
Oh, yes. She finds him reading a novel, a sentimental romance novel.
Totally out of character for the perfect butler.
Exactly. And there's this moment, this brief struggle where he's desperately trying to hide the book from her.
And it's charged with something. It's the closest they ever get to real intimacy, isn't it? Physically, emotionally?
It is. It's the crack in the facade. The moment he could have shown her the real person underneath. But he can't. He just snaps back into his cold, professional persona. A total failure of nerve.
And you feel that failure paved the way for her eventual choice.
Definitely. Her marrying Mr. Ben, leaving Darlington Hall. It feels like a direct response to that emotional desert Stevens created. She chose connection, however imperfect, over nothing.
Over pretending, which sets up that final meeting between them. Day 6 of his trip.
In Little Compton, he finally finds her. Mrs. Ben now. And it's just painful to read.
She admits it, doesn't she? That she's wondered sometimes what life might have been like with him. She shows a vulnerability he just can't match.
She does. But then she confirms she's staying with her husband. The door closes.
And Stevens, even then, he just sits there. He still can't say what he feels. It's the final missed opportunity.
And hanging over that whole scene is the memory of her question from years before.
Why, Mr. Stevens? Why do you always have to pretend?
That just cuts right to the bone, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's the central question of his life and the novel.
Yeah. And it highlights something crucial about Ishiguro's technique here, how Stevens tells the story.
Ah, yes. The unreliable narrator.
We can't just take everything he says at face value, can we? Because he's not really being honest with himself.
Exactly. He's not trying to deceive the reader, necessarily. Mm-hmm. The deception is internal. He filters everything, all his memories, through this lens of professional correctness, of dignity.
So we, the readers, we see the gap. We see the pain and regret he's trying so hard to cover up with all that formal language. It's classic dramatic irony.
It really is.
Yes.
And when you step back, you see that this dignity he dedicated his life to, it's hollow. It's a performance.
A performance that cost him everything that truly matters. Love, connection, moral integrity.
It ends up looking less like nobility and more like, a very sophisticated kind of cowardice, maybe.
That's a harsh way to put it, but maybe accurate. And the symbols in the book really drive this home, don't they? Darlington Hall itself.
Yeah, it mirrors the decline. Once this center of, deeply flawed political influence, now it's being sold off.
To an American, Mr. Faraday. It's going to be more like a museum, a tourist spot. The old order, the rigid hierarchy Stephen served, it's crumbling.
It is. And then there's the title itself, The Remains of the Day.
That phrase just lingers, doesn't it? It's about twilight, the end of his working life. What's left over when the main part is done?
The time left for reflection. Yep. Often painful reflection.
Which leads to that devastating moment of clarity he has near the end.
Oh, that quote is just shattering. I can't even say I made my own mistakes. Really, one has to ask oneself, what dignity is there in that?
He finally gets it. He didn't just make bad choices. He didn't really make any choices. He outsourced his life, his morality, to Lord Darlington. He wasn't even the author of his own failures.
It's a brutal self-assessment.
But then, the ending. It's so quiet, but also deeply unsettling, isn't it? He's on the pier at Weymouth.
Talking to a stranger. And he has this moment of almost complete honesty. He admits his heart is broken, that he wasted his chance at happiness. It feels like a breakthrough.
You think, maybe now things change for him.
But then what's his very next thought? His resolution.
To practice his bantering. To get better at light, superficial conversation for his new American employer, Mr. Faraday.
Exactly. Right after this soul-barring moment, he retreats back into technique. Back into service. It suggests that even with this painful self-knowledge, he can't fundamentally change. Mm-hmm. He defaults back to the old patterns.
So the redemption, if there is any, is incredibly limited. It's almost more tragic because he sees the waste, but still can't quite escape the habit of repression.
Which leaves the reader with this lingering feeling, this universal fear, I think, What if I get to the end and realize I prioritized the wrong things? That my life was wasted?
It's a powerful elegy for the life not lived, for the chances not taken because of fear or misplaced duty.
It really shows the crushing weight of choosing emotional safety, or what seems like safety, over the risk, the courage, of being truly open and honest.
It definitely makes you examine your own life, doesn't it? What matters more, how things look or how they genuinely feel? Authenticity versus performance.
And maybe, just maybe, the hope that even late recognition, even acknowledging the regrets, is better than staying completely blind, even if it hurts.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.